golfers, fighter pilots, elite mountain climbers, motorcycle racers, and brain surgeons. And some emotional responses are more easily controlled than others. Elite performers, as they're sometimes called, seek out the extreme situations that make them perform well and feel more alive. At the other end of the scale are people who don't want any excitement at all. It takes all kinds. But it's easy to demonstrate that many people, estimates run as high as 90%, when put under stress, are unable to think clearly or solve simple problems. They get rattled. They panic. They freeze. Muddled thinking is common in outdoor recreation when people get lost or injured or are otherwise threatened with harm. But even elite performers are not immune to the effects of stress. Greg Norman completely blew the 1996 Masters Golf Tournament after developing a crushing 6-stroke lead over Nick Faldo. He missed a 3.5-foot putt, knocked the ball into the water twice, hooked balls, missed another putt. It was brutal. At the end, Norman and Faldo could only hold each other and weep. When you learn something complex, such as flying, snowboarding, or playing tennis or golf, at first you must think through each move. That is called explicit learning, and it's stored in explicit memory, the kind you can talk about, the kind that allows you to remember a recipe for lasagna. But as you gain more experience, you begin to do the task less consciously. You develop flow, touch, timing, a feeling for it. It becomes second nature, a thing of beauty. That's known as implicit learning. The two neurological systems of explicit and implicit learning are quite separate. Implicit memories are unconscious. Implicit learning is like a natural smile. It comes by way of a different neural pathway from the one that carries explicit memory. Ledoux reports that his mother, who has Alzheimer's disease, cannot remember ordinary events but can still play the accordion, because although her hippocampus is likely damaged by the disease, the memory of how to play accordion comes from an as-yet undamaged part of the brain. Implicit memories are not stored in or necessarily even available to the analytical, reasoning part of the brain. In a normal person, and under just the right conditions of stress, perhaps you're tired, perhaps you're getting a cold, perhaps you're going through a divorce, that implicit system can break down. Then you're left with the explicit system, thinking through each motion like a rank beginner. Malcolm Gladwell, writing in The New Yorker, put it succinctly, "Choking is about thinking too much. Panic is about thinking too little." I flew aerobatics for a number of years and competed with the International Aerobatics Club. One day, my instructor and good friend, Randy Gagne, crashed with a student on board. They went into the ground doing perhaps 250 miles an hour. Until then, I thought I had some special dispensation to fly upside down with impunity. After that accident, I realized I was not an elite performer. Most people aren't. They're just out there to have a good time. And when things go wrong, they have no idea what's happening to them. It may seem as if we live and die by dumb luck, but it is much more subtle and complex than that. Everything was stacked against those snowmobilers, including the way their brains were organized and shaped by continuous adaptation to their environment. Those were not stupid people, nor were they ignorant, nor even necessarily reckless. At the decision point, with all those neuronal networks lighting up, fixing their focus and arming the mechanism of physical action, the one clear and certain thing was that riding up the hill would produce a good feeling and one that, to the organism, seemed necessary, for it arose from emotion aimed at ensuring survival. Since they were already all pumped up, the concept of idleness as a haven of safety couldn't compete with the feeling of motion as survival. To the organism, the decision was clear. The emotional bookmark, that beacon of incentive, burned brightly, and the decision was made in an instant, outside the realm of conscious thought. As Captain Gabba laughed and pushed his rescuer away, he too must have had a good feeling about what he was doing. just before he was pinned and drowned. 4. A gorilla in our midst. The Illinois River in southwestern Oregon has 35 miles of Class 3 to 4 rapids with a Class 5 moss-covered gorge in the middle. That section is known as the Green Wall. Gary Huff, a minister on holiday, knew that the Illinois could only be run at flows between 900 and 3,000 cubic feet per second. He also knew that half an inch of rain would be sufficient to bring the flow above 4,000 cubic feet per second, at which volume the Illinois would be too rough for even the most prodigious paddler. Conditions looked right, if just barely, that Saturday morning when his group began the trip. The flow was 2,000 cubic feet per second. Although a storm was predicted for late Sunday, Huff estimated that they'd have enough time for the three parties attempting the run to get through. He was willing to accept a certain level of risk for the reward of the trip. He had a clear idea of the dynamic forces involved in the environment he was about to enter. He had a reasonable conception of his ability to deal with it, and he knew what changes in the system would overpower his skills. Shortly after Huff's party set out on March 22, 1998, it began to rain. He did the right thing. He ordered the craft pulled out and had his group make camp. It wasn't much like the kind of fun they had planned, but then again, the water was rising so fast they had to move their craft several times to keep them from washing away. Conditions in the real world, the objective hazard level, had exceeded the risk Huff was willing to accept. The environment had changed, and he adapted. Using his reason to manage emotion, and emotion to inform reason, he survived. Between March 21st and 23rd, 3 inches of rain fell, melting snow in the Siskiyou Mountains, adding even more water to the flow. The river rose 15 feet, and the flow reached 13,500 cubic feet per second. According to Charlie Walbridge's River Safety Report, this surge caused havoc among weekend river runners. Anybody who's paid attention to a flooding river will know it, Huff later said of the sound that woke him the next morning. There's the roar of the full-throated river, but on top of that, as if it's a layer you could pick up and remove, there's the hiss. That hiss basically says, keep your distance. That's a pretty subtle cue, I suppose, but to the survivor's mind, all cues are important. They carry information. So a survivor expects the world to keep changing and keeps his senses always tuned to what's up. The survivor is continuously adapting. That hiss was enough for Huff. For those who were not so attuned, there were other cues. Dawn revealed the python that had come in the night to swallow the Illinois whole. When the river has been coming up a foot an hour all night, when it's gone from clear to chocolate milk, when there are no more eddies and there are 18-inch diameter trees going down at 15 miles an hour, it's just not a tough decision, Huff said. But as John F. Kennedy once remarked, there's always some son of a bitch who doesn't get the word. Huff's party, then, watched from the refuge of camp as a party of five on a shredder, a type of raft, and three kayaks came shooting past at around 10 a.m. About half an hour later, they were followed by a second party of five, including at least one kayak. The first group was eaten by the 15-foot standing wave after portaging the Green Wall. The second group managed to portage the Green Wall, but two paddlers were eaten near the Little Green Wall, another hellacious section. They were still operating on a model of the old environment. The results were fatal. One member of each party drowned, and the others lost all their equipment and had to be rescued. One survivor was carried 5 miles downstream before she was able to get out. Walbridge wrote, Coast Guard rescue helicopters picked up 10 people, 6 of whom had flipped boats and become stranded in a sheer-walled section of the canyon. The first man killed, Jeff Alexander, 37, was an experienced river guide. The second, Wilbur Byers, 62, was also a well-known river guide who had many years of experience. It is unlikely that professional guides would intentionally take such a risky run. In fact, They spent some time at the put-in discussing the risks, and everyone agreed that the river could be run. They had a lot of experience at running the river, and it had always been okay. Big water, said their emotional systems, equals big fun. As complex as the brain is, the world is more so. The brain cannot process and organize all the data that arrive. It cannot come up with a reasonable course of action if everything is given equal weight and perceived at equal intensity. That is the difficulty with logic. It's step by step, linear. The world is not. Perceptions come at you like the 6 million hits you get when you do an internet search. Without a powerful search engine, you're paralyzed. One search engine involves emotional bookmarks in which feelings help direct logic and reason to a place where they can do useful work. A second strategy the brain uses for handling complicated problems is to create mental models, stripped-down schematics of the world. A mental model may tell you the rules by which an environment behaves or the color and shape of a familiar object. Suppose you're searching the house for your copy of Moby Dick, and you remember it being a red paperback book, but you don't know where you left it. When you search, you don't examine every item in the house to see if it's Moby Dick. That would be logical, a strict use of the faculty of reason, but it would also be tedious and would take too long. That's how a computer would do it. The fact that you have a mental model of the red paperback copy of Moby Dick allows you to screen out nearly everything you see until, at last, a red book blossoms in your field of vision. But if you're wrong, and it's a blue hardback edition of Moby Dick, chances are that you won't find it, even if the title comes into view. Everyone is familiar with finding something right under my nose. A faulty mental model is part of the explanation. It's the reason that you can get off an elevator on the wrong floor. It's the reason that many card tricks and magic acts work. You see what you expect to see. You see what makes sense. And what makes sense is what matches the mental model. If you do succeed in finding your copy of Moby Dick, your pupils will dilate at the moment you recognize what you're looking for, as they do when you reach the solution to a mathematical problem, or see something you like. My father used to perform a card trick for me and my brothers. Anyone can do it. He'd shuffle a deck and ask us to pick a card, not show it to him, and replace it anywhere in the deck. Then he'd let us shuffle the deck so that it would seem impossible for him to find the card. But when he'd show us the cards one by one, he'd watch our eyes. When we saw the card that we'd picked, our pupils would dilate, and he'd know which card we'd picked. The involuntary physical response is proof that there is an emotional component to the process of matching the model with the world. In more subtle tricks, the magician creates a mental model for you, a short-term memory of the world. Every model of the world comes with its own underlying assumptions based on experience, memories, secondary emotions, and emotional bookmarks, all of which influence what we expect to happen and what we plan to do about it. Then the magician switches realities, and while you stick with the model that is closest to your familiar reality, he reveals the new reality. The disconnect is what's surprising. You believe the magician does the trick, but in fact, you do it yourself. Magic is astonishing only to the extent that you ignore how the brain works. It's a bit of a magic trick, then, to put a boat in a river when 18-inch trees are shooting down it at 15 miles an hour. One of the reasons magic tricks work can be explained through a brain system called working memory. It's a general-purpose workspace, and most of us experience it as attention or conscious thought. In addition, there are specialized systems for verbal and nonverbal information, and they have a type of short-term memory that allows perceptions to be compared with one another over the span of a few seconds. The general-purpose area can take in information from the specialized systems, sight, smell, sound, and so on, and can integrate and process that information through what Ledoux calls an executive function. That area of the brain, located mostly in the frontal lobes, is responsible for making decisions and voluntary movements, as well as directing what sensory input we're paying attention to. It's why we can still carry on a conversation in a room where many people are talking and music is playing. It's why we can choose between getting up and putting on a sweater or turning the thermostat up. As Ledoux and others have explained, working memory can hold only a few things at once, perhaps half a dozen or so. And when something new commands attention, those things are forgotten. Working memory can also retrieve information from long-term memory. The fact that you can read this long sentence is the result of your working memory's ability to hold the beginning, middle, and end all at once and to retrieve definitions and associations from long-term memory and use them to make sense of the words. It is also the result of the fact that you have created mental models of the words. You don't read each letter to decode the word, as a child who is learning to read must. But if you come across words that are too similar, such as psychology and physiology, you may have to pause. The fact that new information, especially emotionally charged information, forces things out of working memory means that we can't pay active attention to too many things at once. Unless something is successfully transferred from working memory into long-term memory, it is lost. We all have this experience when we try to memorize something that has no emotional content, such as an address or driving directions. In most people, the executive function can do one task at a time, and attempting to perform simultaneous tasks that involve a conflict begins to break it down. For example, if you flash the word blue, printed in green ink, on a screen for a second, and then ask someone to say the word or the color, he'll have to stop and think before he answers. The limited nature of working memory, attention, and the executive function, along with the shorthand work of mental models, can cause surprising lapses in the way we process the world and make conscious or unconscious decisions. That is why even experts can miss things that are right under their noses. In May 1989, Lynn Hill, one of the most famous rock climbers in the world, was in Bieu in southern France, preparing to climb a one-pitched bolted route. Bolted routes are where beginners start, because they are the safest of climbing environments. Hill and her husband were simply climbing it as a warm-up. She became distracted as she was tying the rope to her harness and didn't finish her knot. The task of tying the knot had been in working memory when a conversation with a Japanese woman nearby and the act of putting on and tying her shoes bumped it out. With conflicting demands on working memory, she may have unconsciously substituted tying her shoes for tying the climbing rope. As Hill walked back to begin her climb, there was a slight residue of the memory left, but it had not been completely formed. "The thought occurred to me that there was something I needed to do before climbing," she wrote in Climbing Free. The fragments of a half-formed memory had left a gut feeling, an emotional bookmark, and she considered taking off her jacket, which would have revealed the half-tied knot, but I dismissed this thought. She climbed to the top, unaware of the trap she'd set for herself. She had created a mental model that had worked in the past. She was now depending on it to match reality. She asked to be lowered, put her weight on the rope, and the half-tied knot came loose. She fell 72 feet. A tree barely saved her. Charles Perrault is a sociologist known for studying industrial accidents, such as those that occur with nuclear power plants, airlines, and shipping. In Normal Accidents, he wrote that we construct an expected world because we can't handle the complexity of the present one, and then process the information that fits the expected world and find reasons to exclude the information that might contradict it. Unexpected or unlikely interactions are ignored when we make our construction. The snowmelt in the Siskiyou Mountains, the unseasonal rains, were unexpected and unlikely interactions in a system involving water, air, gravity, and terrain faced by boaters on the Illinois River. The possibility that the river could rise 15 feet to reach a flow rate of 13,500 cubic feet per second was outside the normal experience of the river's guides, contradicting their model. It may seem difficult to believe that they could have missed the trees zooming down the river and the noise it was making, but it might be easier than it seems. Mental models can be surprisingly strong, and the abilities of working memory surprisingly fragile. A psychologist who studies how people behave when they're lost told me, "I saw a man I was hiking with smash his compass with a rock because he thought it was broken. He didn't believe we were heading in the right direction." Perceptions do not incorporate the world in a literal way. If you try to imagine the face of your mother, there is no photograph of your mother waiting in your brain. Rather, fragments of the image, including its emotional content, are stored in a dormant form scattered across numerous neural networks. When you call forth your mother's face, they all light up simultaneously in what Antonio Damasio calls a trick of timing to create an illusion that you're seeing your mother's face or something like it. The way we store what we know about the world is much the same. Mental models are distributed across the brain. Jacques Barzin wrote about a man named William Huskisson, a member of Parliament for Liverpool, who was attending the opening of the Liverpool and Manchester Railway on September 15, 1830. At the inauguration, he was run over by the rocket. No one as yet knew how to gauge speed and distance, when and where to step. Man's reflexes failed him in the midst of powers stronger than the horse and the ox. Huskisson's mental model of his world had served him well. He knew how to cross a street crowded with vehicles. They were powered by horses, and he didn't need to calculate their speed. It was second nature to know how much lead time to allow himself to get across. Then his environment changed suddenly. He had never seen anything move as fast as a locomotive. Huskisson looked, saw where the train was, and unconsciously consulted his mental model to rate risk and reward. He then estimated, again outside of consciousness, that he could cross the tracks in time. But his model was rendered useless by a change in the environment brought about by an invention. I don't know what Huskisson was thinking, but since the rocket was the first commercial locomotive, it's possible that he had not seen a train before. If, as a business leader, he had seen a train, it was new information, capable of altering his mental model, yet surely not as firmly embedded as the old, and not properly bookmarked for quick reference. His was a model in transition of a world in transition. It's also likely that excitement was high that day. A Tory Prime Minister and the Duke of Wellington were in attendance, along with Prince Esterhazy, who was very nearly killed too. Railroads were about to be big business, and as a controversial free trade advocate, Huskisson must have had a lot on his mind. The pressure was on, the crowd excitable. After the accident, the crowd stampeded the tracks and tried to attack the infamous Duke of Wellington, who refused to board a train again for more than a dozen years. Huskisson happened to see the Duke of Wellington on another train full of dignitaries, and although estranged from him, he decided to cross the tracks and greet him. So we can imagine that in the excitement and stress of the moment, Huskisson would have been having difficulty holding the important things about his immediate environment in working memory and integrating the conflicting inputs. He was screening out significant information at the decision point, reverting to old familiar models of his world. Older bookmarks may have set the trap. They are, after all, slaved to emotion, which triggers action. His feet moved. All it took was a step or two. Then he was in front of the engine, perhaps recognizing his error, only a second too late. When Amelia and I were first learning to snowboard, we became disoriented in a blizzard at a ski resort in Washington State. We had little experience and less skill, and the other resorts we'd been to, like most, had the lodge at the bottom of the lifts. We saw a long line of people trying to get on a lift. Of course, I knew that the lodge for this ski resort was at the top of the hill, not the bottom. We'd been there for breakfast. But with the stress of exhaustion, dehydration, emerging hypothermia, and the fear I felt for Amelia's safety, I ignored those cues. If I thought about it at all, I'm sure that I couldn't figure out why they were going up again in such a whiteout. Stress doesn't take long to confuse you. We'd only been out a couple of hours. I kept pushing Amelia downhill, away from safety, off into the wilderness. I was able to blank out the evidence of my senses. I could see people going up the lift. I relied on the familiar model of a ski resort, spurred on by the gut feeling that danger was up, safety down. Fortunately, Amelia, who was only 12 years old at the time, was more attuned to her environment, and even in the whiteout, she kept her sense of direction. "Pop," she said, "the lodge is up, not down." Oh, no. What was I thinking? Half-frozen, we climbed back to the lift, rode up to the lodge, and took the gondola down to our car on the other side. I'm grateful that she knew how to walk her own walk. It would have been a long night out. Mental models, emotional bookmarks, and the ability to keep the right things in working memory played a powerful role in determining who lived and who died in the collapse of the World Trade Center towers. When the first airplane hit the North Tower, it cut off all the stairwells and elevators, trapping anyone above the 91st floor. When the second plane hit the South Tower, a stairwell on the northwest side of the building remained open, despite the extensive destruction throughout the area from the 78th to the 84th floors. While 18 people got out by using those stairs, at least 200 went the other way, heading for the roof. A fire warden named Brian Clark stood in the stairwell with his flashlight, asking people as they entered, "Up or down?" And while a few went down into the rising smoke and escaped, most went up. With only 14 minutes left before the collapse, hundreds of people were standing at the wrong end of the stairwell, facing the locked door of the roof. Some had followed Rocco Camage, a window washer who had a key to the roof door. Others relied on a powerfully emotional past experience. When the World Trade Center was bombed in 1993, people had been short-hauled off the roof by helicopter, creating a model of safety and escape that led many up, presumably toward air, not down into smoke. Camage found that his key wouldn't unlock the door. They were trapped. And even if they had all started down at that point, there was not enough time left to reach the street before the collapse. Their previous experience, or the shared experience of others, betrayed them, and they all died. While it's understandable that people could be confused or make wrong decisions under the extremely unusual circumstances in the World Trade Center on that day, it's more baffling that I would fail to grasp something as obvious as the location of a ski lodge, or that river guides could miss huge trees shooting down a river. The guides were, after all, the ones who died. The clients lived. None of us was on a suicide mission. No, they and I had profound lapses in our ability to use working memory properly, to process new information from the world, and to integrate it with long-term memory. And there's plenty of evidence that such lapses are perfectly normal and happen all the time. Arian Mack, a psychologist at the New School for Social Research in New York City, writes that most people have the impression that they simply see what is there and do so merely by opening their eyes and looking. A group of psychologists at Harvard performed a rather disturbing experiment to prove that this isn't the case. They showed a video of basketball players passing the ball and asked people to count the number of passes made by the team wearing either the white or the black uniforms. In the middle of the video, one of two strange things happened. Either a woman with an umbrella or a person in a gorilla costume unexpectedly walked through the center of the action, remaining clearly visible for about 5 seconds. The subjects of the experiment were asked afterward if they noticed anything odd. 35% of the observers failed to notice the woman with the umbrella, even though her presence was obvious to anyone not engaged in the counting task. A control group of people who were not counting passes easily saw the woman with the umbrella because when they were asked to look at the screen, it was with the attitude, "What's up? What might I see there?" It was an attitude open to an unfamiliar world, accepting of whatever was there. There was no model, and there were no expectations. The order, tell me what you see, produces curiosity. The order, count the passes, produces a closed system, a narrowing of attention directed at a particular task, which fills up working memory. The implicit assumption is that you know what you're doing and know what sort of perceptual input you want. However, the demands of the task use up scarce brain resources. It is a magic trick in that it creates a model that directs your attention away from something obvious that the magician, the researcher, is going to do right before your eyes. Magic confirms the idea that you see what you expect to see, and that under the right circumstances, working memory can't be distracted from its task. Such a closed attitude can prevent new perceptions from being incorporated into the model. Such a closed attitude can kill you. Psychologists who study survivors of shipwrecks, plane crashes, natural disasters, and prison camps conclude that the most successful are open to the changing nature of their environment. They are curious to know what's up. But what's most surprising in the experiment at Harvard is that an even larger number of people, 56%, didn't notice the gorilla. One researcher said that he'd ask the subjects, "Did you see anyone walking across the screen?" No, they had not. "Anything at all?" Nothing. When he asked, "Did you notice the gorilla?" the observers would say, "The what?" Another researcher had commercial pilots fly a simulator down to a normal landing. Just as they were making the final approach to landing, the computer caused an airplane to appear where the pilots were supposed to land, parked right in the middle of the windshield. Many pilots just went right on landing without seeing it. Everyone says that the mind plays tricks. But deep down, most people don't believe it. A brisk walk through city traffic will prove that we trust perception to represent the real world faithfully. Yet every day you experience numerous small events in which you lose your senses and then regain them. You say that the mind wanders, and it does, often farther than you think. While everyone is familiar with doing something stupid, it's not stupidity. Focusing attention takes energy, and even then it can be fragmentary. The word focus, being a metaphor of a lens, can be misleading, since sometimes what's needed is a wider field of view. The rest of the time, emotions and mental models of ourselves and our environment must work automatically to create behavior. Most people who engage in risky recreation live in low-risk environments designed specifically so that the consequences of inattention are trivial. But if they take that inattention into the wild, the cost can be high. Actually, the cost can be high anywhere. Recent research demonstrates that talking on a cell phone while driving, whether hands-free or not, causes inattentional blindness, the psychological term for the phenomenon of failing to see the gorilla. At first, it seems to make no sense that you could fail to see a gorilla. But if you understand mental models and working memory, it makes perfect sense. You're counting how many times the players pass the ball. Fine. You set up a model, a simplified representation of ball, man, and motion to facilitate that task. Now a gorilla appears. Gorillas are not helpful in completing the task. They have nothing to do with basketball. Gorillas are irrelevant and would displace the task in working memory. So the brain, efficient system that it is, filters out the gorilla so that you can keep counting. Seeing the gorilla would be a mistake. You'd lose count. What's more worrisome is the pilot not seeing an aircraft on the runway, because that is relevant to the task he's concentrating on. But the model he created before the plane appeared did not contain the plane. And anyway, the pilot wasn't landing a real plane, nor even a real simulator. He was landing a mental model of a plane on a mental model of a runway. Simulators could not be used for training if it weren't for mental models. Once the environment changed, the pilot's mental model was out of date. Some people update their models better than others. They're called survivors. I'm not suggesting that the river guides didn't see the trees shooting down the river. I don't know. They're dead. The light certainly must have hit their retinas. But the research in perception and mental models makes it easier to imagine how they could have discounted their ultimate significance. In the face of uncertainty, Charles Perrault writes, we must, of course, make a judgment, even if only a tentative and temporary one. Making a judgment means we create a mental model of an expected universe. You are actually creating a world that is congruent with your interpretation, even though it may be the wrong world. 5. The Anatomy of an Act of God. On June 25, 2000, two brothers, Rob and David Stone, and their friend Stephen Pinter, all in their 20s, set out to climb the southeast buttress of Cathedral Peak in Yosemite. Although it was rated as an easy climb, 5.6, it involved 6 pitches, rope lengths, to an altitude of 10,940 feet. It was a serious undertaking. In addition, it was Rob's first climb of more than one pitch. But they were young and strong and well-educated. David was more experienced, and if everything went just right, it would be fine. The annoying thing about plans is how rare it is for everything to go just right. They had driven from the San Francisco Bay Area to Yosemite and set up camp about 50 miles from the trail the night before the climb. All the while, they were moving toward a goal, the big climb, where the plan, a memory of the future, tries on reality to see if it fits. Sometimes an idea can drive action as powerfully as an emotion. Plans are an integral part of survival. Plans are generated as one of the many outputs of the brain as it goes about its business of mapping the body and the environment, along with the events taking place in both, resulting in adaptation. Planning is a deep instinct. Animals plan, and a bird that hides seeds has a larger hippocampus than others, suggesting a larger capacity for spatial memory. But planning, predicting the future, may be even more fundamental than animal abilities suggest. In his book Complexity, M. Mitchell Waldrop points out that all complex adaptive systems anticipate the future. Every living creature has an implicit prediction encoded in its genes. Every complex adaptive system is constantly making predictions based on its various internal models of the world. In fact, you can think of internal models as the building blocks of behavior. And like any other building blocks, they can be tested, refined, and rearranged as the system gains experience. The human brain is particularly well-suited to making complex plans that have an emotional component to drive motivation and behavior. Plans are stored in memory just as past events are. To the brain, the future is as real as the past. The difficulty begins when reality doesn't match the plan. Memories are not emotion, and emotion is not memory, but the two work together. Mental models, which are stored in memory, are not emotions either. But they can be engaged with emotion, motivation, cognition, and memory. And since memories can exist in either the past or the future, to the brain it's the same thing. You bookmark the future in order to get there. It's a magic trick. You can slide through time to a world that does not yet exist. David Stone, who had gone rock climbing numerous times, had a mental model of the world of rock walls. He understood the rules that governed them and his movement on them. He had a model of the systems he used, too. The ropes, anchors, harness, quick draws, carabiners, daisy chains. Rock climbers tend to know their stuff. Those elements in his brain had no inherent emotional component. They were just schematics of that world. He also had memories of his climbs on other cliffs, and the excitement he experienced gave those memories a nice emotional quality. Just thinking about climbing again, remembering the future, felt good. It gave him that beacon of incentive. Without having to think about it, he took his mental model of cliffs and superimposed it on the Cathedral Peak, a face he'd never climbed. Conditions had been good in the past. The climbs were successful, the feelings good. So that was the memory, the model, he applied to Cathedral Peak. Logically, he would have been able to tell you, had you asked, that he had no way of knowing what climbing Cathedral Peak would be like. It was a new world, but he was approaching it as if it were familiar. How else can we move forward in time? It's the risk-reward loop. Like David, we all make powerful models of the future. The world we imagine seems as real as the ones we've experienced. We suffuse the model with the emotional values of past realities. And in the thrall of that vision, call it the plan, writ large, we go forth and take action. If things don't go according to the plan, revising such a robust model may be difficult. In an environment that has high objective hazards, the longer it takes to dislodge the imagined world in favor of the real one, the greater the risk. In nature, adaptation is important. The plan is not. It's a Zen thing. We must plan, but we must be able to let go of the plan, too. Psychologists who study survival say that people who are rule followers don't do as well as those who are of independent mind and spirit. When a patient is told that he has 6 months to live, he has two choices: to accept the news and die, or to rebel and live. People who survive cancer in the face of such a diagnosis are notorious. The medical staff observes that they are bad patients, unruly, troublesome. They don't follow directions. They question everything. They're annoying. They're survivors. The Tao Te Ching says, "The rigid person is a disciple of death. The soft, supple, and delicate are lovers of life." My father was a rule breaker, as I have turned out to be. He broke nearly every bone in his body in the war and then broke the rule that it's supposed to kill you. He also wore a big beard when Castro took power in Cuba, partly to cover the scars, but also because it freaked people out. Beards were not cool in 1959. They were an emblem of communism. The plan, then, can become the equivalent of doctor's orders, the tyrannical rule that you can either obey or rebel against. It's one of the many delicate balancing acts of nature, to plan and not to plan. But emotion is a dramatic arc, and like a play or a movie, like Sex or The Hunt, it has to run through three acts, with a struggle in the middle and a climax near the end, when our eyes grow wide. Rob and David Stone and Steven Pinter had fallen under the tyranny of the rule created by their own plan, and were quite naturally following it. The closer they got to the goal, the harder they tried, the more excited they became. Halfway through a Hollywood movie, the hero becomes totally committed to his goal. So there they were, set on that natural emotional arc, and the plan gradually became unshakable. The overwhelming evidence that conditions in the real world were rapidly diverging from their memories of the future made no difference. After all, in a classical drama, the tension comes from the fact that the hero is farthest from his goal when he triumphs. Let's not forget that in some movies, he dies. As additional stresses or unplanned events make it difficult to think clearly, it's no wonder that you find it almost hopeless to change the plan or alter your model to fit reality. You're carried along on your own story of yourself. When the three climbers awoke at 4 a.m. to begin their approach, the first unplanned event occurred. Someone, not a bear, had stolen their food. The plan called for a hike of 3 miles to Cathedral Peak and a starting time of 8 o'clock. David's calculation of how long the six pitches would take put them at the summit around 1 p.m. But now they had to go in search of food. It delayed them for 2 hours. And another stress was added to being tired and hungry, the pressure of schedule. With luck, they calculated that they still might make it to the summit by 3. Hell, they had to. They'd driven all this way. The friction, made up of numerous minor events, was building, and they would try to beat it. They could have admitted the friction in the system and lived with it. There were lesser routes to climb that were closer to the road. They could have had a perfectly good day. But the plan put them on a 3-mile hike, which put them at the base of Cathedral Peak, and that was that. So they rushed over to check the weather board. The sun had come up, the day was gorgeous, but they were just being responsible, doing what they'd done before. The weather board still had the previous day's forecast on it. It called for clear weather, which predicted exactly what they could see for themselves. They knew it was outdated, but why should they expect it to change? They saw what they wanted to see and disregarded what they knew, that high terrain makes for rapid changes in the weather. In the summer, the middle of the afternoon is the most likely time for orographic lifting of warm, moist air, causing weather on those peaks at around 3 p.m., precisely when they'd be arriving. Researchers point out that people tend to take any information as confirmation of their mental models. We are by nature optimists, if optimism means that we believe we see the world as it is. And under the influence of a plan, it's easy to see what we want to see. As for the outdated weather board, that was good enough for us, as Rob commented later. They could have gone to the ranger station, but by now they were in a hurry. They could have brought a weather radio, too. They could have brought waterproof clothing, but the sun was out. Trivial events begin to shape an accident long before it happens. When they arrived at Cathedral Peak, two other climbers were already underway, Lewis Johnson and Stuart Robertson. So Rob, David, and Stephen got ready, but it was 10 o'clock before they started up. 2 hours doesn't seem like much, but two pitches later they could see the clouds moving in. They kept climbing. They'd been awake 6 hours. Also, every foot of altitude brought less oxygen to their brains. Things were getting complicated. The stress load was growing. Friction was building. And unfortunately, they had made no firm bailout plan to tell them when to turn back once stress had begun to erode their ability to reason. Despite the fact that, by the end of the third pitch, with three more to go, we could see distant rain, they all felt that we were outrunning the storm. They actually discussed the weather and made a group decision to press on for the top instead of rappelling off. Even if they had succeeded, they did not consider how rapidly hypothermia could overtake them in their cotton clothing in a cold rain. They were locked in a game of speed chess with Mother Nature, and she unleashed a series of stunning moves. The hailstorm began as they were on the last pitch. David, who was leading, had managed to reach the peak. Rob and Stephen were about to begin the last pitch, with David belaying from above, when suddenly they all felt their hair stand up. Rob knew about St. Elmo's fire, as sailors call it. As the negatively charged lower portion of a thunderhead passes over the ground, it attracts a positive charge from the earth. The charge moves along under the cloud and follows it. When the positive charge reaches anything that can conduct electricity, such as a person, it moves up through the person and creates what's known as a corona discharge. That's what Rob and Stephen were feeling now as they headed up the sixth and last pitch. Just before they reached the summit, as Rob later said, everything around us started to buzz. That was the most terrifying sound I had ever heard. Now there was only one emotion, and it blotted out everything else. Heedless of the risk of falling, Rob and Stephen charged across the wet surface to an overhanging rock in an effort to escape the lightning. They had not reached the summit, but were still clinging to the nearly vertical wall. As they waited beneath a Bible-black sky, the storm slashed at them with hail and rain, and the crackling buzz continued for over 5 minutes. Then it happened. Checkmate. The detonation hammered Rob into the stone wall. He felt the electricity surge through him and out his right arm. It was over in less than 1/100 of a second. Lightning can travel as fast as 54 yards per microsecond. Then he heard Stephen moaning beside him. Lewis Johnson and Stuart Robertson, who were on the summit with David, were screaming. Rob, who had almost reached the top, was near enough to his brother to see him dangling limply from his belay position on the summit. David was moaning weakly. The sight of another person who is injured or dead, especially someone you know, can elicit powerful emotional changes, well known among search and rescue workers, rescue fever. It's a common human reaction to do something foolhardy and even life-threatening while trying to help others. When the World Trade Center collapsed, a man tried to swim from New Jersey to Manhattan to help. He was picked up by a ferryboat captain. Rob found himself scrambling without protection across the wet, extremely exposed rock to save his brother. Despite the risky position he was in, he began rescue breathing. Any mistake on the exposed slab would have been fatal. But he could smell David's burned flesh, and the sensory input only heightened his emotional state, a sort of emotional shock that put him in a position where he could easily have become a second victim. His cognitive abilities were all but shut down, as is typical in such extreme cases. It was only much later that Rob would consider the risk he had taken. So there they were, sticking up into a black storm cloud on a spindle of rock, four guys with an injured man down and possibly dead, trying to move his sagging 190-pound frame away from the edge, and going hypothermic now because they were all wearing what the YOSAR, Yosemite Search and Rescue crew, call death cloth, cotton. They had no waterproof clothing, nothing with which to start a fire, no way to warm David or themselves. The hour was getting late, and they had only one flashlight among them. How different the world seemed now from those memories of the future. As Johnson and Robertson tried to move David, he awoke, believing that he was in British Columbia. Johnson and Robertson set up a rope on an anchor point to lower him. While they were working, the buzzing returned. St. Elmo's fire. Rob and Stephen had already developed a powerful secondary emotion and reacted without thinking. They jumped onto David's rope, putting the weight of four people on the tiny anchor all at once. Fortunately, their luck and the anchor held. It was also fortunate that Johnson had a ham radio and was able to reach someone who contacted John Dill, the YOSAR ranger. Had they waited to see the updated weather board that morning, they would have noticed warnings of lightning. Mother Nature must have been feeling good that day. They all lived. As the accident report noted, Mother Nature chose her targets with a sense of humor. Four are electrical engineers. If you distill all of the psychology, cognitive science, and neuroscience of the last 100 years or so, what you find is that we're always homo, but sometimes not so sapiens. People are emotional creatures, which is to say, physical creatures. Joseph Ledoux concluded that people normally do all sorts of things for reasons that they are not consciously aware of, and that one of the main jobs of consciousness is to keep our life tied together into a coherent story, a self-concept. In other words, everyone is the hero in his own movie. So it should come as no surprise that in many cases, basic survival mechanisms, which have been hardwired into us and sculpted by experience, turn out to be not only the most powerful motivators of behavior, but to operate at their peak efficiency out of reach of the conscious decision-making powers, which makes it easy for reason to be overwhelmed. Once an emotional reaction is underway, there can be an overwhelming impulse to act. But there are many ways of revising the script and adapting in hazardous situations. Training is one of them. Neil Armstrong would not have been able to land Eagle on the moon if it hadn't been for years of rigorous training, not only in the technical stuff, which had to be second nature, but in emotional control. All elite performers train hard, and when you follow in their path, you'd better train hard too, or be exceptionally alert. That's the main difficulty with neophytes who go into the wilderness. We face the same challenges the experts face. Nature doesn't adjust to our level of skill. The practice of Zen teaches that it is impossible to add anything more to a cup that is already full. If you pour in more tea, it simply spills over and is wasted. The same thing is true of the mind. A closed attitude, an attitude that says, "I already know," may cause you to miss important information. Zen teaches openness. Survival instructors refer to that quality of openness as humility. In my experience, elite performers, such as high-angle rescue professionals who risk their lives to save others, have an exceptional balance of boldness and humility. So do astronauts. Just being aware of the traps that can be set by nature can help. It helps to remember that people are primates, with a recent and somewhat untested upgrade, the neocortex, called neo because it was thought to be new. What's new is its size and complexity. What we regard as failures of mind are probably nothing more than the process of nature tinkering with simple rules over a leisurely span of evolutionary time. Nature always runs through many individuals of every species in its experiments, and we are the latest experiment. It's nothing personal, then, when the brain plays tricks. Nothing personal, either, when you die, as Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher, said. Our failures are so common that it's easy to write them off as inexperience, stupidity, or inattention. Most people operate in an environment of such low risk that action, inaction, or the vicissitudes of brains have few consequences. The energy levels, the objective risks, are low. Mistakes spend themselves harmlessly and die out unnoticed instead of growing out of control. Even so, other than on America's highways, which had 42,850 fatalities in 2002, most accidental deaths happen in and around the home, largely because that is where people happen to be while making routine mistakes. But when you take yourself out of that environment and go into the wild, you must evolve new ways of seeing, a new plan. A few years ago, Lyle Lovett and I went down to Ensenada on Chris Haynes's Baja off-road tours with a group of 20 guys, and we rode 500 hard miles in the desert and the mountains. It was the sixth time Lyle had taken the trip with Chris, a motorcycle racer who had run the Baja 1000 for 15 consecutive years. In the liner notes on Lyle's album, The Road to Ensenada, it says, "Thanks to Chris Haynes, Mike's Sky Rancho, the San Nicolas Resort Hotel, and Papas and Beer," which is more or less a map of the trip we took. The group included Lyle's father, Bill Lovett, to whom The Road to Ensenada is dedicated, as well as his assistant, Vance Knowles, and his cellist, John Hagen. Percussionist James Gilmer drove one of the support vehicles, and Lyle's mom, Burnell, rode shotgun in it. Lyle also brought some motorcycling buddies, who ran the spectrum from David Booley, a chef from New York, to Bill Casson, owner of a motorcycle shop in Austin. The ride began on a dirt road that rapidly deteriorated as it was cut and crisscrossed by erosion from torrential rains which had guttered the earth. The cuts turned to ditches which turned to ravines, and before the first hour was out we had a casualty, when a motorcycle shop owner from out east came into a corner carrying too much speed and stuffed his machine into a deep ditch. We call that taking a soil sample. I came around the corner to find him standing in the middle of the path with his face bloody and his thumb broken, or at least badly bent. We were a long way from medical attention. He got into the truck with Burnell. His ride was over. The first day began at the San Nicolas Hotel and ended at Mike's Sky Rancho, a famous Baja motorcycle hangout high in the mountains, with precious little electricity, no phone at all, and an ancient swimming pool that looked like a poisoned waterhole. By the time we had all made it up the mountain and beer had been rationed out, cigar smoke was wafting across the crowd by the pool, mingling with the smell of tortillas from the kitchen. The sun was going down as we realized that Lyle's father, Bill, was missing. Lyle, his mother, and I walked into the parking lot and looked out at the mountains, as if they could tell us something of his fate. But the sun failed, and the immense shapes of the hills melted into the moonless sky, and still there was no sound of a Kawasaki four-stroke engine out there among the pines. The air grew cold. Many of us had taken ice-cold showers in the dim four-bunk rooms and put on sweaters and jackets, and now we stood around, hugging ourselves, thinking about Bill out there alone. Everyone else was accounted for, and it was bad because we weren't looking out for each other, and we were ashamed. After all, If we don't look out for each other, we're no better than coyotes. An hour after dark, Chris mounted a search party consisting of two men on bikes and one in a truck. They encountered Bill, half frozen, doggedly making his way up the mountain, inch by inch, following the faint glow of his Kawasaki.